From Bureaus Worldwide, this is FSM.
Yeah, the city of brotherly love, eh? How you doing? Wednesday it is, the 28th of October. This is the Richie Allen Radio Show from a dark, a grim, and a damp Salford. Lovely to be here. Two terrific guests lined up for you today. Do tweet the programme with your opinions and whatnot as well.
It's the BBG, not the BBC. You're listening to the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Now, later on in the programme, Ivor Cummins will be on. Many of you know all about Ivor Cummins. He's got a hugely successful podcast, a really successful podcast. He's also the co-author of Eat Rich, Live Long. He travels around the world talking about the root causes of modern chronic disease. He originally graduated from UCD in Dublin with a biochemical engineering degree. Lovely guy. He'll be on with me in the second hour. Before that, though, we're off to London, where David Curtin will join the programme. Many of you, of course, will know about David Curtin. He's an MLA, meaning he's a member of the London Assembly. He's running for mayor next year. Heritage Party. He founded the Heritage Party this year. Former member of UKIP. Lots to talk about with David Curtin. So it's a busy Wednesday at Richie Allen Show Towers. Yes, if such a place exists, and it doesn't, I can tell you. Let me tell you. Thanks for joining me. Thanks for putting up with my absence yesterday. I needed it. Needed the time off to do some things, some personal things, and I got them done. So good to be back. Lots happening this week. Lots happening tomorrow as well on the programme. But for today, we'll just get straight into the headlines. Mad stuff today. Danny Dyer from EastEnders was on the BBC this morning, saying that we need to get rid of the eaten, educated rulers and get some working class people in. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe. Andy Burnham, the mayor of Greater Manchester, demanding a circuit break lockdown. The Pope, the Pontiff, has described coronavirus as Lady COVID, and Lady COVID must be obeyed, says the Pontiff. There you are. You didn't think there was any higher authority than the baby Jesus, did you? But according to the Pope on a rope, it's definitely Lady COVID. There's a massive push now coming from Patrick Vallance, Chief Scientific Officer, Chris Whitty, Chief Medical Officer, the other 25 or so SAGE members, most of them the men and women in the pocket of Billy Gates, Billy Poison Jab Gates. Most of Parliament, most of the media, along with these people, massive collective push now to lock down the country again. To keep schools open, maybe, but to close everything else. It is relentless, dear listener. You know this, don't you? And I think it's imminent, sadly. That barrel of monkey spunk, Johnson, has been conspicuous by his absence in the last couple of days. And I think that's because a national lockdown is imminent. It's all happening. Imperial College London yesterday, as you probably know by now, published a study in which they claimed that people don't have immunity from COVID for very long. Surprise, surprise, Scylla might have sang. Now that study is being used to refute the scientists behind the Great Barrington Declaration. Those scientists say protect the old and vulnerable and allow everyone else not vulnerable to get back to normal. Now, speaking of Imperial College London, Julia Hartley Brewer of Talk Radio interviewed Professor Paul Elliott of Imperial College London, epidemiologist, and it was interesting and frustrating in equal measure.
I'm asking you a really simple question. I mean, so, Professor, yeah. I'm not an expert. You're an expert, but I don't pretend to be an expert. But Professor Sunetra Gupta, a professor at Oxford University, an epidemiologist with expertise in immunology, vaccine development, and mathematical modelling of infectious diseases, she, along with Carl Hennigan, professor of evidence-based medicine at Oxford University, and many others, say, well, it can't just be antibodies. There's T cell immunity. This is widely accepted among experts in your field. Why is it not possible that a lot of people in this country and around the world have actually got, already developed some level of immunity through T cells, not just antibodies?
Julia, can I spell it out in words of one syllable? There is T cell immunity, but we are in the middle of a pandemic. And at the moment, so we're doing another study called REACT1, which is looking at the spread of the virus in the population.
Yeah.
The virus is spreading everywhere in this country. It's going up. And despite whatever immunity levels there might be, the facts are that the virus is, the R value is still above one. And the virus is continuing to spread.
Yeah, it is continuing to spread. It's at the top of our street now. As I speak with you, it might be outside the door by 7 o'clock. This guy is on Sage, I should have mentioned, advising the government.
...to spread at an alarming rate through the population, not only in young people, but right across the age range, to the vulnerable people at older ages. So just looking at the facts, we are not being protected from this virus.
Well, apart from the fact that we're not all dying at the same rate, and can it just finally, can you explain Sweden then? What's happening in Sweden?
What about Sweden? What was his answer?
So what's happening in Sweden is that the infection rate is going up.
How many deaths are they having per day?
I'm afraid I can't
tell you. I can tell you the figure. It's two.
Two a day in Sweden?
Two people a population of 10 million and two people a day die.
I don't particularly want to comment on Sweden. I'm going to comment on...
Well, of course you don't want to particularly comment on Sweden, Professor. It doesn't suit you. It doesn't lend much weight to your argument, does it, what's going on in Sweden?
On what's happening.
Well, it is relevant. How on earth are people,
England,
given that we've not got these lockdown and tier measures and all the things that are suggested by Sage and others in Sweden, and they're living largely free lives, not wearing masks, socially distancing, yes, some people working from home, but going to bars and restaurants, living their lives relatively freely, and yet two people a day are dying. Yes, it's going up slightly because, of course, it's autumn. This is a respiratory illness. How do you explain that in the context of we can all possibly die from this virus because we haven't got antibodies?
So the situation in Sweden is different. The population density is different. The culture is different. In the UK, in England, which is what we're measuring, the rates are going up. More people are going to hospital and more people are dying.
Yes.
And if they continue to go up, yet more people will go into hospital and yet more people die. What we have to do is control this virus. We have to turn the R value down, and we have to, and the fact of, you know, are we all immune? No, we're not all immune.
No one said we were all immune.
We can see that the virus is continuing to rise, and we have to do something to address that. What we can do is public health measures until we get a vaccine.
Until we get a vaccine. Hold your applause for Julia Hartley Brewer. I'm a big admirer of hers as a broadcaster. She's technically very sound and is a very bright woman. And I've been listening to Julia Hartley Brewer before you even heard of her, dear listener. Long, long time ago. She's good, but hold your applause. A lot of open goals being missed here by Julia. So until we get a vaccine, back to the host.
I just find it absolutely extraordinary that someone as eminent and knowledgeable about this as you refuses to accept that your explanation does not explain why in Sweden people can live a normal life and only two people a day are dying from this virus. If what you are saying is the case and people do not have any T-cell immunity and there's no way of creating herd immunity in this sort of way, then they would be dying. There'll be body bags all over the streets of Stockholm, and there aren't.
So the rates of infection in Sweden are higher than amongst their Scandinavian neighbours. So Sweden is a very interesting case. They've taken a slightly different route, but at the end of the day, they do socially distance. They are taking care. And, Sweden is, have their own issues to deal with. In England and in the UK, I come back to the fact that the rates of the virus
are continuing
to increase.
We know that. They do that every autumn. It's respiratory disease, and every respiratory disease, the death rates and the infection rates go up every autumn. Professor Paul Elliott, I know you've got no intention of answering my direct question. I'll give up.
Why give up? Why not ask him, is he lying? You see, you won't answer the question, Professor Elliott. Are you being hamstrung? People are not dying in greater numbers than last October 2019 or October 2018. As the national death rate hasn't increased, Professor Elliott. The government, sir, admitted that people had COVID listed as a cause of death on their death certificates when they had been hit by a car or drowned or fallen off a feckin' roof. Professor Elliott, these are the reasons I asked you to hold your applause for Julia Hartley Brewer. She's asleep on her watch. It's not good enough. She could have said to Elliott that she herself, to her great credit, exposed the failings of the PCR test. Why didn't she do that? The PCR test is not fit for purpose. So who are these cases you are finding? She could say that the Daily Mail and the Telegraph ran a devastating series of articles proving that flu has disappeared. She could have suggested that flu is now being called COVID. Why didn't she do that? Are you lying, Professor Paul Elliott? And if so, why? How dare you come on to my nationally broadcast radio programme and lie through your teeth? So don't be so quick to praise Julia Hartley Brewer, and I like her. It's not good enough. Right? Oh, you're making yourself... Listen, I'm the best on planet Earth at this stuff. At taking on these people. And she used to be. But there are a lot of places these people won't go while seemingly giving them a bit of a chasing. It's not good enough to say, oh, you're not going to give me the answer I want, so goodbye. Take it to the logical conclusion, I would say to any presenter. He's lying through his teeth, insulting your intelligence. You have all the facts to hand. The fake death rates, the death certificates listed as COVID when the guy fell under a fucking combine harvester. All of that stuff. But she left them off. James O'Brien, LBC. Staggering stuff, this. O'Brien, another nationally broadcast presenter, attempted today to lay the blame for scepticism, COVID scepticism, at the feet of the media, and wanted to challenge the media outlets that claim the government are the government is exaggerating. O'Brien wanted to take on the media outlets in the UK, the ones which are claiming the government is exaggerating about COVID. Feast your ears. This is new. I mean, this is really new.
I think we've got a huge problem when it comes to my profession, and I don't know quite how to play it. Because let me give you a little bit of a personal testimony. I don't know, right? Nobody knows. Science is an attempt to understand. It comes from the Latin scientia, which means knowledge. But science isn't knowledge. Science is the application of knowledge to circumstances. Science is, by definition, wrong. And by that, I simply mean that it is always capable of being superseded when more evidence becomes available. It's the best available explanation for the observable evidence. Okay, that is what science does. Radio presenters and newspaper columnists, in many ways, do the exact opposite. Radio presenters and newspaper columnists take knowledge, information, manipulate it, mold it, shape it to elicit from you, the consumer, the biggest emotional reaction.
Yes, James. And that's what you do every day of the week. You cherry-pick facts to support your own not very well-informed point of view, while you ignore anything and everything that contradicts it, no matter the source. This is laughable. It's hilarious. O'Brien is trying to set himself apart from the rest of the UK broadcast media. He goes on.
That's tabloid sensibilities in a nutshell. One or two of us have managed to find a way to employ similar tactics to do the work of the angels, but usually it's work that is designed to either frighten, enrage, or manipulate you. Usually wrongly.
You did get that, didn't you?
One or two of us have managed to find a way to employ similar tactics to do the work of the angels.
One or two of us have managed to find a way to use the similar tactics of the bad media to do the work of the angels. And he didn't say that with his tongue in his cheek. He didn't say that with a wry smile. There's no irony there. That's megalomania. It's astonishing that this is primetime radio in the UK in 2020. He goes on to blame the media as a whole of playing the game of populism. So the newspapers which challenge the government on COVID and provide a platform to the scientists who say that lockdown is harmful, those newspapers and radio stations are pandering to conspiracy theorists. It's populism, says James O'Brien. So which ones in particular is he referring to?
I think that's why. And at the moment, I'm not minded to mention any names, partly because I suppose it could be embarrassing, but also partly because I don't think that these people do it deliberately. I think they can't help themselves, you know. I think it is like a toolbox, and you can only work with the tools that are in it. But after 4 or 5 years of really weapons-grade populist ignorance, the media seems to be full of people who have decided to treat coronavirus in exactly the same way, which is why...
Like you, O'Brien, like you! You go on there every morning on your nationally broadcast radio show demanding lockdown to destroy the economy and to cause a health crisis, a tsunami, and you ignore the fact that Harvard University, that Yale University, that Stanford University, that Oxford University have an abundance of men and women who say that lockdown is harmful. You are doing exactly what you claim the other broadcast journalists and newspaper writers are doing. This is, if this wasn't so serious, you'd be rolling around laughing at this.
Why, when the chief scientist comes forward and warns that we may soon, by mid-November, return to the 200-a-day death toll, and then we find ourselves, before the end of October, passing the 360 mark, I do wonder how much of the problem lies with people in my profession, and less so on this particular issue, but also in politics, who keep insisting that the scientists are exaggerating, or the scientists are embellishing, or the scientists are scaremongering.
Because all of the evidence demonstrates that the government and its advisors are scaremongering and embellishing. Neil Ferguson, hello? Millions will die, hello? Well, he said half a million. So I was embellishing there just a bit. Half a million. James O'Brien might have a few bob, might have a nice apartment in London, but you're a little man. A little permanently red-faced man with little man syndrome. And when he hears this, O'Brien, and O'Brien will hear it, narcissistic megalomaniacs can't resist listening to or reading any coverage of themselves. When he hears this, it stings like a bitch. Useless, incompetent, you couldn't beat an amoeba in a game of Trivial Pursuit. Dreadful. Dreadful what they dress up as journalism. Are you looking forward to Christmas, dear listener? Here's Sky News' Sarah Jamieson. What are you going to do? How many people will you have around your table on Christmas Day?
We still don't know for certain how many people will be allowed around the dining table this Christmas. But if people do choose to break the rules and hold larger family gatherings than are permitted, how will it be policed? I'm joined now by the West Midlands Police and Crime Commissioner, David Jamieson. Hello to you, Mr. Jamieson.
Hello, good afternoon.
So, as I said, we don't yet know whether the rule of six will still apply at Christmas, whether households will be allowed to mix or not. But how will your force be dealing with breaches of the rules over the Christmas period?
I pinch myself. I know I've said this a thousand times. It is a bit of a cliche now. I admit when I descend into cliche, this I pinch myself. Am I really listening to a journalist asking a guy about policing the rule of six around Christmas Day dining tables? And I pinch really hard and I look back at the TV and I'm still awake and it is happening. What's the force going to do then, David Jamieson, the Police and Crime Commissioner for the West Midlands?
Well, let's be clear. It's police don't make up the rules. It is government that make up the rules, and it is for the police then to enforce those rules. What would be very helpful if the government now said what those rules are, so we could make preparations, and more important, so that families can prepare. Now, whatever those rules are, I don't think there'll be the appetite or the resources of the police to be breaking up small gatherings of people in and around those communities. I don't think that is at all feasible. But if groups of, let's say, 30 or 40 people started gathering together and not complying with the COVID rules, then I think it would be appropriate then for the police to step in.
So a family of five that has granny and grandpa around for Christmas lunch isn't going to get a knock on the door from the police saying you're one over the rule of six?
Well, I certainly would hope that wouldn't be the case. And frankly, this wouldn't be the resources for the police to do it. But I think what I've been saying is that we should be focusing on the larger outbreaks and that tiny minority of people who are flagrantly ignoring the rules and just flouting the law, really. And those are the people that the police need to be enforcing. But most of the time, the police will be there to make sure that communities are safe and that people can enjoy their Christmas as best as they possibly can in the circumstances which we now live in.
Yeah, there you go. I know you're thinking, where have I heard him before, eh? Aren't you? You're thinking, where have I heard him before? Well, think of this. Think back, 1976. No, was it 1977, was it? You can see here the Death Star orbiting the forest moon of Endor. That's him. You know that's him, right? Admiral Akbar. It's a trap. It's a trap. Sam Cooke and What a Wonderful World on the Richie Allen Radio Show. Just before we welcome David Curtin to the programme, Gabriel Scally, great surname, Scally, not Scully. And a Scally, if you live in the Northwest, you'll know what a Scally is. I'm not going to tell you. You can look it up. But Gabriel Scally is a professor of public health. He's an Independent Sage member. Now, Independent Sage was set up because Independent Sage didn't believe that real Sage was going far enough, amazingly. Sage is made up of Chris Whitty, Patrick Vallance and many others. They say, lockdown now, and stay indoors and keep the lockdowns until the vaccine comes. Independent Sage would have you burning your underpants 3 times a week, fumigating your homes, killing your firstborn. They're mad. Here's Gabriel Scally, asked by Sky Sari Houston about Crimbo, about Christmas.
I don't think there's any chance of it being normal, but it could be. There could be some celebration and there could be some family.
There might be some celebration.
Gatherings, but we need a real discussion about how that can happen safely. But more than anything else, we actually need to get a grip on this virus now, because we're still going in the wrong direction. And there is no sign of that decisive action that is needed. First of all, to clamp down on the virus, to have more restrictions so that we can reduce the level of the virus. But also, just as importantly, if not more importantly, a complete revamp of the testing and tracing.
Yeah, these guys are lunatics. This guy wants to lock down now. And he went on to say for maybe somewhere between 6 and 8 weeks, right up to Christmas. And in the meantime, compel people, compel them to sign up to test and trace, to download the app and turn your Bluetooth on and be followed around for the rest of your bloody life. Let's welcome David Curtin to the show. I'm really looking forward to speaking with David. I've seen him do a lot of interviews, talk radio. I've seen him on RT quite a bit. He's a really good guy. I mentioned at the top of the programme that David is running for Mayor of London. He will be running for Mayor of London next year. He founded the Heritage Party. You know that he's a former member of UKIP. Today he's an MLA, meaning he's a member of the London Assembly. It's a real pleasure to welcome David Curtin to the programme. David, welcome. How are you?
Hi, I'm great. Thank you. Good to be here.
Thanks for doing it. I should have asked you on the programme a long time ago, but here you are. Just before you came on, I was running down the news headlines and I had to pinch myself. I'm 45. I'm a live and let live type of guy. I'm not too fond of governments and rules and regulations. And I'm listening to an array of men and women telling us that we can forget about any prospect of having a normal Christmas, that we shouldn't think about or expect. Can you believe that we're here in 2020, that we're here in this type of language?
Yeah, look, if someone had told me this is going to happen a year ago, I really wouldn't have believed it, because we are in the West. You know, we're supposed to be a free society. We're supposed to have freedom of speech, freedom of assembly. You can meet who you want, where you can go where you want in your own country. And just all of that has gone in 6 months. It's quite shocking and it's horrifying, and it's clear that this is for no logical reason, and yet the people who are in the government, the powers that be, seem to be trying to ramp up this crazy narrative more and more, further and further, and they're giving notice that, okay, we're going to cancel Christmas, and some people are even saying, you know, if you meet more than 6 people in your home, the police are going to come round and split you up. I mean, this is, you know, this is the kind of thing you'd expect to happen in the old Soviet Union or East Germany, not in Great Britain, Ireland, or anywhere else in Europe, Western Europe, certainly.
In the absence of the other side, they refuse to come on radio programmes like this. That's fair enough. It's a free world. They can do what they want. But in the absence of the other side, I'll be the devil's advocate. They say that this virus is deadly. Lethal, Matt Hancock has described it as. They say that yesterday 360 plus people died in the country, and that the death rate is going to double every few weeks, that it's out of control, and they don't like imposing these restrictions, but they have to, and they won't allow us to allow the virus, as they say, rip through society. We've got to protect the elderly, and this is the way to do it, they say.
Yeah, well, in what you just said, I mean, there's all kinds of loaded phrases, and I know you're playing devil's advocate, but this is the kind of way that they use language. And they talk about the virus ripping through society, that it's going to kill huge numbers of people. I mean, this simply isn't true. I was really worried about this back in January and February when I saw the things and pictures and reports coming out of Wuhan in China, because, you know, heaven knows what was going on there. But in March, it just seemed there was a day when the media just suddenly flipped and turned on the fear. And I thought, this is odd. You know, they're just suddenly all coordinated together in pumping a fear narrative that this is the worst thing possible. We all need to lock down. This is going to go on for months and months. Life is going to change. That happened. It was about March the 6th, something like that. And then, of course, the UK started to lock down on March the 22nd to 25th that week. But we now have 6 or 7 months of real observed scientific data, which shows, yes, there was a peak, there were some excess deaths in April, May, but that's gone away. You know, it's like what happens in a flu season. And all over the summer, there wasn't any excess deaths at all from COVID, you know, or anything else. It was just normal. Now we are in October. This is when people get more flu. They get more coronaviruses. They get more rhinoviruses. But they're not talking about this. You know, the government, SAGE, the mainstream media proponents of this narrative, they aren't actually even mentioning this is normal. This is what happens every single year. People go back to university, they go back to school, they go back to work after holidays, and people get more illnesses, and people who are, you know, older, sadly, they do die from these things. But this is just a normal thing, and so that is what you'd never ever hear from the people who are pushing this lockdown narrative.
Tell me, What about your fellow assembly members, David? Obviously, you're in constant conversation with your colleagues. Is it a mixed bag? How do they feel about what's happening?
Yeah, well, I mean, the assembly at the moment is a quite a funny thing, because since March, we haven't really hardly ever been in the building together. I mean, it was the building was closed, City Hall in London, for 4 or 5 months. And we went back in September and October for a few meetings. But most of the meetings have been online. So I haven't actually had too much of a chance to have sort of personal contacts and conversations with people. But you have the Labour and the Greens are all right on the lockdown, terrified that this is the worst thing in the world narrative. You have the Conservatives are a mixed bag. I mean, I call them the fake Conservatives as a party. But, you know, there's one or two actually on the London Assembly who are really decent. You know, I get on with them very, very well. But they will never say anything that goes against Boris Johnson or Matt Hancock or whatever is coming out of the government. So they're all publicly supporting all of the measurements that are being put in by the Johnson government. Interestingly, though, they'll always oppose Sadiq Khan, as I usually do, because, you know, on almost everything he's wrong. Now Sadiq Khan wants a national lockdown, which they're calling a 2-week circuit breaker. But of course, everybody knows if you have you start a 2-week lockdown, it's not going to just last 2 weeks. It's going to go on and on and on, just like it happened in March and April. So,
and is it imminent, David?
Labour is calling for.
That's right. Sorry to interrupt you. Is it imminent, do you think? I'm beginning to feel like it might be imminent. Mm. Johnson has been fairly quiet this week so far. And traditionally, when he goes quiet, or a prime minister goes quiet like that, a bombshell is coming. Are they going to give in, do you think, and impose this national circuit breaker?
I hope not, but I wouldn't be surprised if they do. And I'm actually surprised they didn't do it earlier. I mean, I think they were going to try to do this on the weekend of the 17th of October or maybe the weekend after. But, you know, we're now into the school half terms. I really thought they were going to do it before that, like they've done in Wales and Ireland and Northern Ireland. But in England, well, they have locked down. Yeah, you know, at least a third of the country, in Manchester, Liverpool, South Yorkshire, Sheffield, they're going to do Leeds and West Yorkshire on Friday. So they are one bit by bit locking down bits of England. And this is disastrous for people. I think that, you know, something is coming, because you've seen even today in some of the newspapers, they're beginning to propagandize this. This narrative that, oh, you know, where this is going to be a long, long peak all over the winter, and therefore we need to lock everything down. But as I said, this is just normal. This is what normally happens with viruses in the winter, but they're now calling it COVID. It's all COVID, and then we need to shut everything down, even though, you know, they're just really not talking about anything that's unusual.
Do you think
it's coming?
Do you think, I shouldn't ask you do you think, I should ask you what do you think? There are those who believe, and their voices are getting louder in the mainstream media. I'm thinking of some of the Telegraph writers. There are people like Alison Pearson, who's a great journalist, and others at the Telegraph, who are now seemingly beginning to believe that the government knows that this is the wrong approach, but it's doing it anyway. If that is the case, is that because politicians, as a rule, are reluctant to say we made a mistake, or is there something more sinister going on? Writers like Peter Hitchens, for example, is beginning to think that this dystopian normality that we're kind of waking up to every day these days might have been the plan all along, or is that a conspiracy theory too far?
Well, you know, I think there's all kinds of different levels in this, and I think there's different people at different levels. I think there are some people who want to save face. You know, there's some people, yeah, I think they know this has been a massive mistake, but they're so invested in it. They have been pushing this line for 6 months. If they turn around now and they say, look, we were wrong, all of this damage we've done to the economy was for no reason, but you know, hands up. We've got it wrong. Now we're going to do what Sweden did. We're just going to, like, let people do what they want, open everything up, say to people, be careful. You know, if you've got symptoms of something, stay at home. That would be very sensible. You know, if you've got symptoms, don't go and mix with older people who are going to probably catch something from you. Absolutely. I think that's one level. I think there's another level of people who have got financial investments, who stand to gain a lot of money, or friends of theirs stand to gain a lot of money, who have invested in vaccine companies or PPE companies or Amazon, you know, in businesses which are now taking up lots and lots of market share, from other companies that are going out of business. So I think there's that level. But I think you do also have the level of people who are involved with the World Economic Forum and the Great Reset and Klaus Schwab and these people. And that's no secret. I mean, they're very, very open.
It's all out there.
The World Economic Forum, the United Nations. They want a Great Reset. They want to reshape and rebuild and reimagine and reset the world. I think there's some people who are these Marxist utopians who really either believe that, either because they're useful idiots or because they're quite wicked people and they really don't care about individual liberty and people having the right to choose what they want to do with their lives. So I think you've got all those different levels there with different people in different positions.
You make a good point about the vaccine companies. I won't say I was surprised. I've been a journalist for many years now, and I've often come across stories where politicians or even government advisors were found to have conflict of interest. But to learn that Sir Patrick Vallance has shares worth £800,000 in GSK, and he is one of the more vocal voices in keeping us locked down until a vaccine can come along, you don't have to be Bernstein, you don't have to be the greatest journalist that ever lived, do you, David, to understand there's something going on there?
Yeah, I mean, to my mind, that is an obvious, blatant conflict of interest. I have no idea why he's still in his job. I mean, you really need to have someone there. You need people really who are whiter than white. And this SAGE committee and people there, they it seems to be very, very opaque, not transparent at all. I mean, it's very, very difficult to find out who's in it, what the deliberations were in their meetings. And they're people that seem to be running the country, because yeah. You've got a government full of people who are very, very poor at maths and science and statistics, and they're just like, you know, they SAGE comes along and says, here's the paper, here's a scientific paper, this is the science, and they say, oh, okay, well, this is the science, and they just basically regurgitate it without actually having much of an understanding of what's there, let alone the ability to analyze it and critique it and look at the statistics and say, well, look, hang on a minute, that's not the way you should present a graph, and certainly that we shouldn't actually be making national policy on the basis of the modeling that you've presented. But it doesn't seem like there's anybody in government who's elected who has that sort of mathematical and scientific ability.
It's very sinister. One of the more sinister aspects of this, of course, is those learned men and women from some of the Ivy League universities that we've all heard of who are, you know, advocating for a different approach. And to say they're being marginalised is an understatement. And I try to communicate that to people. When my listeners who are worried about the virus and who believe the government, and I do have listeners who believe the government, they say, Richie, why are you so personally opposed to what the government is doing? And I say, well, why would you take Valance and Whitty, and maybe you should do, because they've gone to uni, they've got their degrees, so let's listen to them, but why would you completely turn a deaf ear to these other very learned men and women, and why are you not concerned that the media is not giving these men and women equal time? I mean, the UK media hardly touched the scientists behind the Great Barrington Declaration. I had Martin Kulldorff on here, but I don't know of another radio station in the country that interviewed him. And he's a Harvard School of Medicine professor. The media, David, it's wretched, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the media is really a propaganda tool. I mean, you would have, you know, Lenin and Stalin would be proud of them, really. Yeah. You know, I look at the BBC and I think, well, you know, what you're putting out now is no different to what you'd have had in Pravda in the days of the Soviet Union. You've got one official line and that's it. And there is no deviation from that line. As you say, there's many, many eminent scientists who are coming out, and they're actually making a very, very good, rational, logical case based on empirical data for why all the measures that we got in place simply are really not working, and they're in some cases doing more harm than good. You know, the 10 o'clock curfew, for example, there's no scientific evidence for that. There's a lot of evidence that says actually it's making things worse. The rule of six, there's no scientific evidence. Why should you say six people? Why not seven? Why not eight? Yeah. Why not 20?
Arbitrary.
And so on. Masks. Yeah. I mean, for months we were told don't wear a mask because it doesn't have any effect in stopping the virus. And now suddenly everyone has to wear masks, even though they don't have much effect on stopping the virus. And in some cases they might do more harm than good, because most people actually don't change their masks. They just wear the same mask over and over again. And these like medical masks actually don't stop anything coming through, because the gaps in them are much bigger than the actual diameter of the virus. So it's really just ridiculous.
When I said you were coming on, David, today, a number of people got in touch with me, because we don't often get, you know, elected assembly members on again, politicians tend to avoid these types of programs. So thanks for coming on. Let me just remind our listeners, David Curtin is our guest, and David founded the Heritage Party recently, former member of UKIP. I'm going to say this too. I really admire the stance you took when you left UKIP. I've got to say this now. I absolutely support the right to free speech for Tommy Robinson. I don't believe that Tommy Robinson should have been kicked off Twitter, should have been kicked off Facebook. And I do not believe that Tommy's PayPal account should have been suspended. But I don't like Tommy, and I wouldn't be in any political organisation with him either. So I appreciated the stance you took on that at the time. I really appreciated that. David is running for mayor next year, David Curtin. And when I announced you were coming on, David, one of the most common emails I got today with common questions was, please ask David to give us some advice on our right to be exempt from mask wearing. Some of my listeners said, Richie, I'm getting harassed for not wearing a mask. And as far as I understand it, my medical history is private. It's between me and my physician. And I'm being told that I must prove this or I must prove that. David, what are people obliged to do, as far as you understand it, if they don't want to wear a mask?
Well, as far as I can see from the regulations, I mean, there's no requirement for you to show or prove that you have a medical condition. I mean, I do, and I say I'm exempt because I am. And usually that's fine. The only time it's been a problem is when I was getting a flight. I was in Heathrow Airport. People kept on asking me all the time. So, but you can get one of these printout things. From gov.uk, and it says, I'm exempt from wearing a face covering. And I just put that in a lanyard, wore it around my neck, and then everybody left me alone. You know, and I think I've had problems actually now getting into pubs, because they all now have a person at the door checking you, and they won't let you go in and walk 2 meters to the table and sit down where you can take your mask off. You've got to wear a mask to go through the door to the table, then you can take it off. It's utterly ridiculous. But there is no requirement for you to have a medical certificate, because you are allowed to be, you are exempt actually if wearing a mask causes you anxiety, and I know a lot of people have anxiety about wearing a mask. That's what it says in the regulations. So my advice, if you are getting trouble, and more people are asking about this, just print yourself off one of these cards that says I'm exempt, stick it in a lanyard, it looks official, and then usually people leave you alone.
Good.
That's what I found.
Good advice. You heard David Curtin there. Now, you're running for mayor next year. I'm not a pessimist. I'm not a naysayer, and I don't like being negative, but you know the machines you're up against. You know that, David. You know the money involved. You know the corruption involved. You know that it's like, for you to win, it'll be like climbing Everest in your birthday suit. Excuse my graphic images there. But fair play to you. But fair
sounds
play
rather
to,
painful.
I know. It sounds painful. But fair play to you. Why are you doing it? I understand that you're very concerned about certain issues. I know you're very concerned about free speech is one big issue for you, isn't it, at the moment?
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, we've seen this political correctness, which is suffocating and it's corrosive, just grow and grow and grow over the last 20 years or more. But specifically in the last 5 years, it's just become a beast which has got right out of hand. Now you have people in Speaker's Corner in London being arrested for speaking about things, after the...
Give us an example of that, David.
After the Freedom Rally on the 26th of September, there was a world-renowned German doctor, Dr. Heiko Schoening.
Of course.
And he was trying to give a speech in Trafalgar Square about coronavirus and just saying that it's no worse than a bad flu season. We don't need all of these measurements. Riot police came in and closed down the rally. Then a few people went up to Speaker's Corner. He tried to give a speech again. Then again, the riot police were there and they all surrounded him and arrested him and bundled him into the back of a big police van and took him away. And he was in police custody for nearly a day. I mean, this is a horrific thing that's happening in London. How can you have in London riot police arresting people in Speaker's Corner, the home of free speech, for saying something that perhaps Sadiq Khan doesn't agree with or the government doesn't agree with? This is just symbolic of the erosion of our rights to freedom of speech, freedom of conscience in this country. So I'm standing for mayor because I want it back. You know, I want back our liberty. I want back common sense. I just want London to be a city that people like to be in again. I first moved to London in 1993, is a long time ago, and it was a lovely place to be. You know, for a big world city, It was very, very safe. It was an enjoyable place to be. You had a lot of fun. And, you know, everyone could just go on. You know, no one was really into identity politics and, you know, I've got a big chip on my shoulder because I'm transgender or I'm black or anything else, you know, which you've got now. Everyone just got along. But that's gone. It's going and it's gone. And it, you know, if we don't get someone in who's sensible, and I hope I represent that, it's just going to go completely. I mean, can you imagine? Another 4 years of Sadiq Khan, four more years of rising crime, four more years of chaos on the roads where we get these pop-up bicycle lanes, road blockages everywhere, which are stopping vehicles from going around. And you know, four more years of someone who at the moment is calling for London to be locked down. I mean, how can you have a mayor of London who wants to lock down the Greater London
and the economic impact of that? I suppose I should be putting the Sadiq Khan case in his absence, but I'm just not going to because it would sound pretty hollow coming from me. I'm in Salford anyway. The London election, I mean, I suppose the London election does affect everybody in the country regardless of where you are. I'm sure it does, but
yeah,
I want to ask you this on identity politics, and I know you've had a lot to say about the Black Lives Matter movement and about racism in the UK. For our listeners listening overseas who might be hearing about David for the first time, David's dad hails from Jamaica and his mum is British. I suppose in the media today they would describe David as a gentleman of colour. So, I mean, your opinion is interesting anyway. Is there some middle ground, David? When I get people, it seems that there are polar opposites. I get people on this programme who tell me that racism doesn't exist in terms of it isn't institutional. I'm told that there are always a few racists here and there, but it isn't institutional. And then the other people I hear from are convinced that racism is institutional. Is there some middle ground to be found here? I mean, what sort of UK did your dad experience when he came over from Jamaica? I mean, I hear from a lot of gentlemen. Well, I lived in Brent for a time and I met a lot of Jamaican gentlemen there, many of them in their 60s and 70s. And they told me that it was hard at times dealing with the naked racism. And they said, Richie, it had an effect on us. And I'm sure it's had an effect on our families, our children and our grandchildren. So is there some middle ground that we can approach when we talk about racism, do you think?
Yeah, I think, I mean, when it comes to my dad, just to clear that up, he never came to the UK. And actually, I never met him. Because he left before I was born. So I was brought up with my mother in Sussex. And for me, it was hard. It was hard in the 70s and the early 80s because there was real racism. You know, there were people daubing NF symbols, you know, in places around and so on. But that, you know, largely evaporated towards the late 80s, the 90s. I was obviously a bit older. I think the 90s were a great decade because I experienced really that no one really cared. You know, they were just, I'm David, someone else there's, you know, there's Anne, there's Juan, whatever. Everyone's just, you know people by their first name. And color of skin really didn't matter. But now it's gone the other way. And everyone, race has become like a massive issue again. And I think that's been stirred up. Is what I call cultural Marxism, where you've got the people trying to inculcate dissatisfaction and conflict between different groups. And, you know, the original Marxism is you have the workers and you have the bourgeoisie, the business class. And they try to say, workers, you're oppressed by the business people. Rise up, take control of what they have and you'll be happy. Of course, that doesn't work well. No, it never works properly. It never has done. We see that in history. But you've got that now translated into all kinds of different oppressive victim narratives. So you've got black people are oppressed by white people. Black people need to see themselves as oppressed and dissatisfied, and they need to smash white privilege. And then you got like women, the feminist thing. You got what, women are oppressed by men, so they need to rise up and smash the patriarchy. You've got all these different narratives. The Black Lives Matter thing is just one of them. But it's all stirred up and it's all fabricated. And the people that get into Black Lives Matter are encouraged to see themselves that way, rather than to see all the fantastic opportunities people have in this country. And this is really one of the most wonderful countries for everybody to get on, because not everybody's going to make it to the top. There's not going to be equal outcomes, but we have equal opportunities. And you've got someone with Indian heritage being the chancellor, and also the Home Secretary. You've got someone with Pakistani heritage the London mayor. Obviously, I don't agree with him, I've never mentioned that. I just disagree with him because he's a really bad politics and common sense.
But your point of view is obviously not a, it obviously doesn't endear you to certain ethnic groups in the country. I'm sure there are, Black men and women who would listen to this and they would be cheesed off by that. But you're honest. You say it at least as you see it. But there would be, I know there are Black people listening to this now. There are at least three Black listeners who email me all the time. And they would say, Richie, that's fine, David, saying that. But the other day we had lads harassed by the police for giving each other a fist bump. We know that Black men and women are more likely to be annoyed, harassed, to be stopped by the police. And they tell me that, whether I like to admit it or not, they say that unconscious bias is a real thing, they say. They say they know this to be true. They know that no matter how well they get dressed up, David, no matter how well they present themselves, they get polished up, they have the hair done, they go into an interview situation, they know in many instances that the colour of their skin is an issue before they even start to talk about their resume. And they say, Richie, if guys like you say that that isn't going on, they say, well, you're just burying your head in the sand. Unconscious bias is real, they say. What do you say?
I would disagree with that. And going back to the whole crime issue you mentioned, first of all, that first point, you have, Cressida Dick even said that herself, and she's very much into the, Black Lives Matter unconscious bias thing. She said a few months ago that young Black men are 8 times more likely to commit a violent crime than an average person in the population. So I think you do need policing in proportion to the likelihood of someone committing a crime.
Sorry to interrupt you, David. I'm loving this conversation, but we're going to go probably another 6 or 7 minutes, then we'll have to move on. I hope you will come back in the future. Let me dig down into that. Cressida Dick says that Black men or young Black men are 7 or 8 times more likely to commit a violent crime. Why is that? Why do you think? I mean, I'm not sure. Look, I'm not some bleeding hearts liberal lefty. I'm not anything really. But I find that unfair. I can't. Surely the circumstances people are brought up in has got to have something to do with that. If that is true, why is it true?
Fatherlessness.
You turned out all right, didn't you?
I did. But, statistically, I'm an outlier. I'm very, very grateful to my mother for being a fantastic mother and doing everything that she could for me, but statistically, on average, if you grow up with a married mother and father, you have better life outcomes in every area. You have better employment outcomes, better financial outcomes, better educational attainment, less likely to get involved in crime and gangs, less likely to be depressed, less likely to get involved in drugs. And there are some people who all the odds are stacked against them and things work out fine just through sheer force of will or that's the way it goes. And there are people who come from very privileged backgrounds where they've got everything and they become, their life is chaotic and everything goes wrong. So, of course, there are outliers. But in general, the bell curve of success lies very much placed at the better end of outcomes, successful outcomes. If you come from a family which is stable. And I think family breakdown is far, far higher among Black families than it is among white families, and it's much higher in white families than it is in Pakistani, Indian, Bangladeshi families. And I think that is something.
Why then? Let me dig into this before we run out of time. Let me dig as deep into this as I possibly can in the time we have left. Again, black listeners might say, God, David is selling us out here, they might say. Is he suggesting that there's some moral problem, fundamentally, some moral problem with black men? There can't be.
All black men. Not of course. You've got to take it in individual cases, you know, because there are many wonderful black men who stay, you know, as fathers to their children. But there are a lot who, you know, it's not just black men, but it seems to be, like, looking at statistics and studies, there are more that would leave their the women that bear their children and go on.
And what's the answer? What's the answer for that then? Why do you think? I mean, if black men are more prone to leaving the nest permanently, has anybody attempted to try? If the statistics do bear that out, and I'll take your word for it today, but I will obviously look into it. And I hope my listeners know, I'm no virtue signaler here now. I'm just doing my job. I'm challenging what David is saying, because I don't know this to be true. So if black men are more likely to leave the nest, has anybody tried to ascertain why?
I'm not going to judge, you know, any particular culture or anything. I don't want to do that. But, you know, I mean, what we need to do is get around to fixing this. And we need to get around by fixing this by saying family matters. And it's become politically correct now to talk about there's many, many different types of families and they're all equal. They're not. The best and most stable form of family is to have a mother, married mother and father, who stay together, have their own children and bring their own children up. That's not politically correct, because that is offensive to all kinds of people. That's offensive to feminists.
Yeah.
It's offensive to people who come from alternative lifestyles and so on. And people get offended by that. But it's a fact, and it's a fact that I will stand by. And what I will say is, one, we need to change the tax system so it does not punish married mothers and fathers, married couples that stay together, which at the moment it does, because you pay more tax as a married couple with children than if you split up, which is absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah.
So we need to change that. We need to start rewarding people from staying together. We need to encourage people to stay together, and we need to be far, far more serious about what family is and what family does, and to recognize that marriage is not just about self-fulfillment, you getting what you want, but it's about being the bedrock of a family to create a stable home, to have children and to bring children up. Because if you create a stable home for children, they're going to do far, far better. But if you don't create a stable home, they're far, far more likely to get involved in gangs.
That is spoken.
Teenage boys.
That is spoken like a God-fearing Christian. And I don't say that with any disrespect whatsoever. I have great respect for your beliefs, and I'm not paying lip service to that. I'm agnostic myself, but I'm surrounded by Christians, David, church-going Christians like yourself, so I do appreciate that. Listen, I wish you the very best in the election next year. I'm hoping that you'll drop in on us from time to time before that. You're welcome back anytime. It's been a really interesting conversation, and there are lots of other things we could have talked about today, not least of which is Brexit, but we might get into that before the end of the year.
We could talk all evening about that.
But no, I've really enjoyed it, David. Thanks for your time today. And like I said, all the best, and do come back real soon.
Thanks, Richie. Good to chat.
Cheers, David. Lovely, wasn't he? David Curtin there, live on the line from his home in London. And a number of our listeners wanted me to challenge David about his on his opinions on abortion and stuff like that. And a number of people said to me today, Richie, in secular London, he's not got much chance because he's a conservative Christian and he is very vocal on his anti-abortion stance and all of that. Sure, look, of course, we can get into that in the future. I respect his opinion. He's entitled to those opinions, isn't he? Isn't he? Whether you like them or not. What do I think of abortion? Well, I've said what I think about it before. I don't like it. But I'm a bloke, aren't I? And when a woman says to me, you don't have any right to tell me what I can do with my body and what I should do. Well, I run out of answers to that, really. So I just shut my mouth. Right, it's 3.5 minutes past the hour. This is the Richie Allen Radio Show for Wednesday, October 28th, 2020. Shall we have a tune? Let's have a tune. Loads of tweets came in there, by the way, when I was chatting with David. Lots of tweets. Lightning Seeds back with plenty more in 3 minutes. Lightning Seeds change on the Richie Allen Radio Show. Wednesday's programme. It's lovely to be with you. It always is. We're off to FSN now for the headlines. Headlines, 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 schmedlines. Have we got headlines? Does anything work here? Where's my producer? Have we got headlines? Headlines from FSN. Don't forget, in a couple of moments' time, Ivor Cummins. Ivor Cummins joins the programme. Can't wait to talk to him. Over to FSN.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Nick Harper. There's just 6 days of voting left in the US presidential election, but more than 70 million Americans have already cast their ballots. In India, COVID-19 cases are nearing the 8 million mark, moving the country closer to becoming the world's worst affected. And there's been a second night of violent protests in the US city of Philadelphia following the fatal police shooting of an African-American man.
Thank you, Nick. Good stuff. Yes, Ivor Cummins, really thrilled to be speaking with him. He's standing by and will join the programme in about 2.5 minutes' time. Huge interest in this as well.
Renowned healer Mark Byerski travels the world to find the most unique and powerful crystals for self-healing. Since the ancient times, crystals have been used as healing tools. They hold a natural healing vibration and are highly charged in positive energy. Mark teaches how to channel the universal energy and transfer it to the crystal to activate its healing power. Each crystal is used for its unique ability to target a different physical or emotional challenge. Mark Byerski is an author, healer, speaker, and founder of the Pure Energy Healing Academy. He shares powerful messages of inspiration and healing on his daily YouTube videos, reaching millions worldwide. Mark's crystals, healing oils, and incense sticks are most sought after by other healers. His collection is available online at www.markbyerski.com. His work is presented through Lemon House, a company that creates and curates consciously made gifts.
Welcome back to the program. Hey, let me tell you. The Dr. Thomas Binder will be on the program next week. I came across him on Twitter. He's a cardiologist based in Baden in Switzerland. And he's a very well-known and very well-respected cardiologist, medical doctor. He has been very vocal in terms of his opposition to the COVID measures, the lockdown, and his concern at the damages lockdown does for health, for mental health, and many other things. You can follow him, I tell you, on Twitter. I've been tweeting him today, so follow him on Twitter. He puts out these posts with absolute reams of information about coronavirus. Lovely bloke. Had a lovely chat with him today on the old Dog and Bone, and he said he would come on the programme next week. It seems a number of our listeners, at least my listeners, who use Twitter, they knew about Thomas Binder before me. That's no surprise. Most people know what's going on before me. 10 minutes past the hour it is. Let's get Ivor Cummins on the programme. Well, when I mentioned that Ivor was coming on the programme today, massive response to it. Massive response to this. I'm delighted that he's agreed to come on. He has a hugely successful podcast, and I've been watching episodes of it in recent days. He's been speaking to people in recent weeks, not just people here, but people in Sweden, challenging the lockdown narrative. He is famous for many things, but he co-authored a book called Eat Rich, Live Long a couple of years ago, which many of my listeners have read. Seemingly they've been inundating me with information about that. He travels the world talking about the root causes of chronic disease and looks at a nutritional approach to that. And he began, I suppose, well, he began his adult life having graduated the University College Dublin, UCD, with a degree in biochemical engineering. And he's been very vocal as well about the, as I just said a second ago, the approach to dealing with coronavirus. I'm just delighted that he's on the show today. Let's say a big Cead Míle Fáilte to the one and only Ivor Cummins. Ivor, welcome to the show. How are you?
Hey, Richie, I'm great. And it's great to be here. Thank you.
It's an honour, my friend, and I've been watching lots and lots of your YouTube podcast. Folks, go to youtube.com. There's only one Ivor Cummins. They're brilliant, mate. Brilliant work, providing a platform for people to talk about these issues. It's terrific. Now, you're not in the old sod. You're not home at the old sod today. You're travelling. What do you make of what's going on in our country? Ireland recently moved to level 5 lockdown, which is basically a total lockdown for the country. It's doing unimaginable damage to the economy and to people's lives. Give us your own take on it, Ivor.
Yeah, well, Richie, I guess I predicted this in September, and it's on the record on Twitter, and I said as we head into the winter, we're going to see the normal seasonal resurgence of all viruses, but this year, corona, in a competitive way, will be the dominant one. That's just the way the virome works. So we're going to see more SARS-CoV-2 in PCR tests, and we know that from the Glasgow study, that coronaviruses, as you come into winter in Northern Europe, they rise in prevalence. But what we're not going to see is a disproportionate or very unusual excess mortality compared to prior seasons. That's what I predicted. Yeah. And so far, that's exactly what we're seeing. But I also predicted that we will see an unprecedented amount of bizarre behavior by the authorities, and we will see lockdowns. And people ask me, well, why will we see lockdowns if we don't have excess mortality that's severe, if we don't have these problems? And I said, because they must lock down, because they are trapped by their own logic. So in other words, if we go with no lockdowns into the winter, and it turns out it has a broadly similar excess respiratory mortality as prior years, then everyone will turn around and say, oh, so the so-called conspiracy theorists were right. It was a seasonal virus. It did hit in March, April in Northern Europe. Now we're seeing a similar winter to prior winters. And the first passing was really the main hit from the virus. So why are we doing all this stuff? So I figured they're going to start locking down in a panic mode, even though there isn't a justification for it, in order to say that this winter is now not so bad because we locked down. So you see the deceit? It's an old trick, you know. And I figured you're going to see some really mad stuff, and that's what we're seeing right now.
You got it bang on. Today, the UK government advisors, the SAGE committee, they're telling us that, well, they're crowing about the fact that they've proven to be right. They said, we warned you in September that cases are doubling week on week. We're seeing an extraordinary amount of cases. We saw 360 plus deaths yesterday. Hospitals are at bursting point, they're telling us. So we suggest, or we recommend, another hard lockdown. So they would say, Ivor, they would say, well, look, the evidence is bearing out now that this has come back very strong in the second wave, and we've got no option now to, in order to stop hospital beds filling up, hospitals collapsing, we need now to lock down again. Why are they wrong?
Well, I would say that hospitals, and it's probably pretty much similar to Ireland, we have a relatively normal hospital loading for respiratory. To date so far, the respiratory mortality in the UK is not particularly different than prior years for all that talk. There's a lot of exaggeration, I think, of hospital loading. So I don't see any Nightingale hospitals set up. I don't see them beginning to fill. I don't see any of that. I see lots of reports of that. I think certain pockets of the UK that were less affected the first time will naturally, like all viruses in history, in the following winter, you will see pockets of pressure. But I think that if we weren't PCR testing like crazy, I don't think this would be in the news at all. You know, because in prior winters, when hospitals had a lot of respiratory action going on, it didn't really make the news. So I think we need to be really careful to say, what we're seeing for the whole of the UK, is it hugely different than the same time in prior seasons when there was, say, a bad flu going on? And I think the answer is no. But I have yet to see the data that says otherwise, and perhaps it will be forthcoming. But right now it's not.
Yeah, you are right. Number of national newspapers in the last couple of days have looked at the data for 2020, comparing it to 2019, 2018 and 2017. And it suggests that you're not just right, you're properly right. This is a fact. It isn't any worse. Why then? Why did they persist with testing asymptomatic people if they suspect or have any evidence that the PCR test is as unreliable as some think it is? Why are they pushing it, do you think, Ivor?
Well, yeah, the PCR test. So just for the record, the published science and the facts on this, the PCR test has possibly a 0.5 or to 1% false positive rate. It's called specificity. So if you test 10,000 people, you may get 50 to 100 that are not really positives, but they test positive. So if your prevalence is at a couple of hundred people in 10,000, a lot of those are false positives. But that's not the only problem. You've also got people where the PCR test basically finds a tiny fragment of the virus and multiplies it up by a zillion times. So you've got people with dead viral fragments who had the problem 6 weeks ago, and now they're recovered, they're fine. You're going to pick those up as positives. You're going to pick up people who have very small amounts of virus that are de facto immune and are not going to transmit. They'll come up as positives. And then you've got a chunk of the people who are positive who are symptomatic and transmissible. And they're the number we should be looking at, but they're not. They're looking at the whole number, which includes all the junk I just described. So that's the first problem. And that's one of the reasons why we have absolutely exponential positive PCRs, but we have relatively little mortality and impact. And it's kind of as simple as that. So in the first wave of a new virus, you get a pretty big hit. And we did, very sadly. It is important to note in Ireland, though, in the first wave, the real epidemic back in April, 95% of the people who passed were never given intensive care to try to save them. And it wasn't because we're cruel. It was an ethical decision that the people, 19 out of 20 of the people who passed, were so ill, comorbid, or close to the door that it wasn't appropriate to try and save them. So that should strike home with people to realise that fact. And England, I'd say, would be broadly similar. So the second wave, they call it, is not a second wave. It's a normal winter resurgence of the virus. And like a bad flu, the following winter it resurges, but it's never anything like the first wave. So we went through the worst, and we never even breached our ICU capacity back in April.
Same
you know,
here.
The Nightingale hospitals were never used.
Same here. They've reopened Manchester Central, which I'm sure you will know, Ivor. Used to be the GMEX Centre. It used to be a big concert venue many years ago, and then it became a place for conferences and stuff. But they've cordoned this off again now, and they said they're ready to receive the inevitable stream of overflow from the hospitals. But I've got to be honest and back you up. Again, there isn't any evidence. I've got my sources in Manchester and Salford. There's no evidence that anybody used that hospital first time around. And it doesn't look like anybody's going to be using it this time around either. And we could mention the O2 in London as well. Let me remind our listeners, you are with the Richie Allen Radio Show live from Salford. Ivor Cummins. Massive interest in Ivor when I announced he was coming on, and thanks to him for coming on short notice as well. Go to thefatemperor.com. That's thefatemperor.com. Ivor is on Twitter. If you are new to his work, it's @fatemperor, and he's got hundreds of thousands of subscribers on YouTube, and they watch his excellent presentations on his own work as much as his work on the COVID response as well. I get people telling me, Ivor, and I'm just an English graduate, mate, to be honest. I don't know anything about biochemistry. I don't have your grounding, your education. But I get people telling me, Richie, they've never even isolated this coronavirus. Now, is there any truth to that, Ivor, or is that just a conspiracy theory that I can dismiss?
Yeah, I mean, I usually stick to the data and the published data and the hardcore government and official websites, peer-reviewed journals, and I actually avoid ever getting into anything that's in the grey zone. Now, I believe it may be technically true. It is technically true that it has not been isolated completely as it should be, but I'm not sure it makes that much difference. I'm willing to roll with the fact that there was a new virus, which was named SARS-CoV-2, and it entered Europe in November 19. First deaths were in December, and then seasonally the virus triggered, as they do, in March, April, and that's where we saw the impact. Yeah. And I think whether it was created, which is technically possible, no problem, released by accident, you know, in China from that lab in Wuhan, or whether indeed it's been fully verified and characterized, all of that will come out in long term. But the main thing now is, for me, what is the true impact of it compared to a bad flu? And the answer is, it's in the envelope of a bad flu, as Professor John Lee has said on Irish primetime television last Friday. One, a UK professor of pathology, brilliant man, I interviewed him. And that's it. It's in the envelope of a bad flu. And the impact in Europe from the death figures, without a question, is similar to a bad flu year. And then the question, the million-dollar question is, do lockdowns deliver more benefit than cost to society? And the answer is a resounding no.
Definitely.
They offer way less benefit than cost. So lockdowns are an absolute disastrous strategy, regardless of where the virus came from. They are a disaster. So we have an Irish group now, people may be interested to know, with heading to 50 doctors and surgeons who are researchers who understand this. They've come together. They got a letter printed in the Irish Times, and they are meeting now almost daily, pulling in support and funding and putting together the science. And you're going to see some pretty big things in the next couple of weeks in Ireland. Basically, there's a folder which I helped gather papers for. The one on lockdowns being ineffective is stuffed with peer-reviewed published science in the last 6 months. The one on lockdown impacts being disastrous is stuffed with peer-reviewed published papers, and so on. There's no question about the technical truth here. No question. Lockdowns are a disastrous implementation, and we copied them from China. And in doing so, we threw into the U-bend the WHO guidelines of November 2019, the Irish pandemic guidelines of 2019, all of the pandemic and epidemic guidelines of the last 20, 30 years, all that work developing them was flushed down the toilet, and we copied China.
Why?
And there is no science to support it.
Why was the world... See, these are... I suppose they have to be rhetorical questions. I don't expect you to know everything. It sounds like you know quite a bit, Ivor, to your credit. But why did the world go in seeming lockstep in terms of its approach? That was a bit of a red flag for me at the very outset of all of this.
Well, yeah, to be honest, Richie, at the very start, my antennae went up because I'm 30 years in complex problem-solving leadership. And let's just say, after 30 years leading teams in multi-million dollar problems that are threatening your business and your jobs, you get pretty good at it. And at the start, I was amazed to hear radio and television discussions of a new normal. And I thought, but sure, the epidemic hasn't even really hit us yet. Yeah. It's going to pass by April or May. The ICUs are going to be empty and the deaths are going to end. And then they're going to have to give up this nonsense. But why are they talking about a new normal now before anything's even really happened? And we know from the China data and the Italian data what the demographic is. And we know from the Diamond Princess cruise ship, we know the impact, what it's going to be. And it turned out to be exactly what we knew it would be. So why are they talking about a new normal and we'll never go back? And I think that speaks to the plans of major international organizations of huge influence. And there's no conspiracy here. I just hasten to add for your listeners, zero conspiracy theory, because it's not a conspiracy when they tell you what they're doing.
Yeah.
So essentially, there's the WHO have clearly driven hysteria. That's on the record because we can just see it with our own eyes. The World Economic Forum is pushing and advertising on bush shelters in the UK and all over the world the Great Reset or the Fourth Industrial Revolution. And they have stated on the record that Corona is a huge opportunity not to be wasted to reshape the world in a new fashion. You know, whether you agree with them or not, they're a non-democratic organization.
That's right.
So I don't like that. But maybe they're correct to reshape the world, but they're public. And they've jumped on Corona and published many papers. And on their website, all of their plans are there. They were on the front of Time magazine only a week ago. So it's all public. They're extremely influential. They're bristling with corporate sponsors and funders. And they're run by one of the richest men in the world. His name's Schwab. And they've been working for 20 years to create a new world kind of management system. And they love Corona, and they must have it be a crisis. If Corona is just a really bad flu, they lose the opportunity of decades, and they waste it. And then we've got like various vaccine foundations, and we've got the UN, and we've got, you know, the European Vaccine Alliances, and all of them want stuff that Corona will give them. So no conspiracy. And I'd say all of those worldwide organizations jumped on Corona back in February. They've remorselessly sat on Corona ever since, driving the worldwide governments. And the governments, in turn, created fear in the population out of a panic. And now the people are screeching back at the governments to lock them down and keep them safe, which is a kind of group psychosis or herd kind of panic.
Yeah.
So in fairness, in each country, you've got panic driven by governments and driven in return by the people, like kind of a destructive, chaotic loop, feedback loop. And then you've got all the big organizations on top fueling it from above. So it's actually quite easy to explain. It's a mess, and the mess will continue until people wake up and realize this is a bad flu equivalent. Nothing more, nothing less. It's tough. A lot of people passed in the first wave. We've been here for a million years. You know, in 2018, we had a similar mortality count across Europe, 360 million people, very similar to this year. And 2000, the year 2000, millennium year was worse. 68 was much worse. The Spanish flu in 18 was in a different universe. We've been here before. It's sad. Viruses are tough. But this year, we decided to lose the plot, copy China, and destroy our societies in a mindless, I don't know, journey towards God knows where.
God knows
and we're
where.
Still on.
As you're speaking, we get a lot of tweets to this live show, lots and lots of tweets. We're getting lots now, I can tell you. You're listening to Ivor Cummins, mostly complimentary. I won't read out the flattering ones. I'll read out a critic. It's not a critical one. Alan Jessen has a good question. He says, Richie, please ask Ivor, what about the data that shows that many people were issued a death certificate saying that they had died with COVID when in fact they had a heart attack or something else was wrong with them? I don't think Alan is denying the legitimacy of the virus, but he's saying that the numbers themselves are questionable because we assign somebody a COVID death when, I mean, you mentioned yourself earlier on, Ivor, they were at death's door anyway, many of these people.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, a complex problem-solving leader is trained above all else for pattern recognition and noting differences or changes. In fact, Kepler-Trago, one of the top problem-solving methodologies in the world, is utterly dependent on comparing differences. So what's different this year? Well, we have mega PCR testing, and across the world, driven by the WHO, it's on the record, across the world, everyone was told to change how you do death certificates. 2020 March, first time in history. Anyone who had the smell of coronavirus SARS-CoV-2 around them was to be a death by COVID-19. So that's a fact. And that's a first in history. So if you went to a bad flu year and you did massive amounts of PCR testing and found influenza A, H1N1, let's say, and you were told every death where you found a smell of H1N1 was a H1N1 flu death, you would have seen the exact same thing.
Yeah.
Right? But this is the first year we've done this. So naturally, we're going to see crazy stuff. So I would ask the question, why did the WHO not say, guys, if the person clearly died driven by this disease, call it COVID? And if they demonstrably had other issues and it wasn't really the primary cause, don't call it COVID. Note it in the small print that SARS-CoV-2 was present. And we'll have both sets of data. And I'll tell you, it would have looked very different.
Very different indeed. Let's get to one or two more tweets. Ivor, I never agreed a time with Ivor, but we finish at 7 o'clock UK time anyway. If you can stick around for another 15, 20 minutes, Ivor, I'd really appreciate that. I should have mentioned the time, but if you've got to run anywhere, let me know. I don't mind that either. Ivor Cummins is our guest, and there is massive interest in this. TheFatEmperor.com. Subscribe to him on YouTube. He's got hundreds of thousands of subscribers. And the book he co-authored a couple of years back, hugely popular. Many of you telling me today that you read the book. Miss Ali says, Richie, tell Ivor I'm sorry, but what kind of flu has ever had no symptoms? A lot of my listeners are cheesed off in recent months, Ivor, with the fact they keep saying this. It's almost like become a mantra. What sort of illness is so bad that you've got to get a test to realise if you've actually got it? And this is really driving people mad. And but you've alluded to this already with the PCR testing. You know, testing asymptomatic people. And mean you mentioned bits of old viruses in people's systems. But just to that point, you know, what kind of flu has ever had no symptoms whatsoever? I'm sure you can have the flu without realising it, or am I wrong?
Absolutely. You can have the flu or any virus. The viruses preceded us. We came from the viral. We sprang from viruses. They were here long before us. Humans carry around 100 different viruses, and every species on Earth, even bacteria, have around 100 viruses each that are kind of unique to them. So there's 100 times more viruses than us. And it's not really the virus wants to kill you. It's just people who have immune system problems and are aged or moribund or have other issues, sometimes the virus gets out of hand. I mean, that's a way of looking at it. So it's not that the virus is attacking us. We are it. It is us, in a sense. So if you PCR test, you're going to find, like I said, all kinds of stuff. And in a flu year, if you tested, like manically tested people everywhere, you would find vast numbers of asymptomatic people carrying a specific flu. But we never do that. Normally, and we've got to get back to normal here. Normally, we test symptomatic people who have distress. But this year, we started testing everyone. So we only saw what we would have seen any other year with other potent viruses. But this year is the first time we're doing it. Now, there is a precedent. It was done before. And I must say this. Your listeners need to Google Spiegel, S-P-I-E-G-A-L or E-L, swine flu. And you'll get an article from Spiegel, a mainstream German newspaper from 2010. And they went through the swine flu debacle. And they explain it there. And essentially, they were testing with the new PCR rapid testing. And in England, in the UK, during the summer, they had an enormous panic because they had a massive spike in swine flu. But guess what? They had the lowest deaths of any summer, any month, at that exact same time. But they saw masses of swine flu, H1N1. So if you test crazy amounts, you will see all kinds of stuff that looks scary. But the reality is, you're only seeing because you're hyper-looking. And right. You would have seen it 3 years ago, you would have seen it 5 years ago, but you never looked. That's all.
Vic has tweeted us, Richie, Ivor has nailed it, he says. Here's my prediction, says Vic. When we get the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine over the next few weeks or months, Boris Johnson will start to downgrade COVID to flu category of threat. This is a big concern for many of my listeners. Their big concern is that Patrick Vallance, the chief scientific officer, and Chris Whitty, the chief medical officer, want to keep the pain flowing for people, the misery of the situation, so that we will have the vaccine in the spring or earlier. Now, Ivor, you probably don't know much about me from Adam. I'm not anti-vaccines. I have had people on the programme before, many of them actual doctors, like yourself, qualified men, PhDs, academics, and they take a dim view of vaccines, but I would always be argumentative and put the other side of it. I'm not anti-anything. I'm pro-proven safe medicine. And I believe that vaccines have in the past and could play a useful role in public health. That's my own personal opinion. But I believe recently there's been a few things I'm not too happy with, the Gardasil vaccine and one or two others. But anyway, I won't get into that. But I want, no need for that preamble, I suppose. But I just wanted to say I'm not anti-vaccine. But I wouldn't touch a vaccine either next year that's been rushed into production when they've admitted themselves that it takes nearly a decade to do it properly, if they do it properly at all. And I do remember, as a journalist who's worked in the mainstream for years before I went independent, I remember narcolepsy cases after a very hastily produced swine flu vaccine. So is that something that you're looking at? Is there an argument to be made? Do you understand why people think they're keeping the pain, you know, they're keeping us in this state of misery so that we'll be happy to see the vaccine in the spring? What do you think of it yourself?
Oh, yeah, the V word, I call it. I steer clear of the vaccine because it's got so toxic, the topic, which is weird because I got involved in statin discussions and we all argued the science and the efficacy and the value of them.
Yeah.
And you're kind of allowed to. The only drug you're not allowed to talk about are vaccines. So I say, okay, I'm steering clear of that one. I went to China on business a couple of years back and I had to get a couple of vaccines. I didn't even ask what they were. I wandered down to the doctor, slapped them in my arm, and I walked out of there. I didn't even ask what they were. I don't care. So I'm the opposite of anti-vax.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, okay. I just, look, I have, my sympathies go out hugely to the people, the small percentage who are affected. And it is a tough situation because when you trigger the immune system, there are often, you know, negative consequences that can occur. And my sympathies to those people. But me personally, you know, I'm 50 years of age, metabolically healthy, and I don't personally care about them.
Fair enough.
I will say one thing. The swine flu was a debacle because 30 top members of pharmaceutical industry met with the WHO in 2009, and it's in that Spiegel article. You got to read this article, mainstream. And they decided to downgrade the pandemic bar. So a pandemic, they took out that it had to cause huge death and disruption across many countries, and they basically dropped it down to you just got a new virus across many countries. And that was done in conjunction with pharma leaders who used their power of persuasion and said, guys, if you don't declare a pandemic and drop the bar for what a pandemic is, we're not going to develop vaccines. So the governments got together and they said, okay, and they dropped the bar. And then the pharma went off and says, oh, we made vaccines. But once they made them, of course, the governments didn't want to waste billions of dollars.
Yeah.
So they felt they had to roll them out. And what happened was the narcolepsy, and they also gave them indemnity that they had no liability for them. So they asked them to rush a vaccine and told them they weren't responsible if it was crap. Guess what happened?
Yeah.
So you had all these problems and they paid out, I don't know, hundreds of millions, I think, in damages to these poor young people. And that was from our tax dollars. That was not from them.
That's right. That's the thing, isn't it? I mean, I wholeheartedly respect your right to your opinion on vaccines, and your opinion is as educated as anybody else's. I personally, what I did say, I'm not anti-vaccine. I'm not going to go back on that. I'm not a hypocrite. I wouldn't touch them with a barge pole. I wouldn't. Based solely on the fact that those companies, not just for vaccine damages, but they've been fined billions and billions of dollars and pounds and yen over the years for dodgy dealings and, you know, corruption. I don't have any time. And I wouldn't talk. And I do believe in Ireland there's a big problem with Gardasil. And I believe the Irish media and the Irish political class is covering it up. But look, that's just my opinion. It doesn't mean anything. Go on.
I'll briefly Yeah, I don't like the topic, but the Gardasil, that's the one for cervical.
That's right. Yeah, human papillomavirus, well, yeah.
I always say it's very easy, and this is going to apply to a coronavirus vaccine too. So 6 years is the nominal, and they're going to try and do this in 8 or 9 months. Okay, where's that going to go? The other thing is that they spent 30 years. Professor John Lee said there was a company set up or a kind of a government body that was trying to find a cure for coronaviruses via vaccine. And they ran for around 35 years and then they disbanded because they've never been able to do one successfully for technical reasons we won't get into.
Yeah.
And now they're going to rush it out in 10 months instead of 6 years and it's going to be magic. I mean, come on. All you need to know that's silly is have a brain. It's nothing to do with conspiracy theories. No. It just makes no sense. So if you go back to Gardasil then, I just did the numbers. Someone kept trying to drag me into the Gardasil thing. So I said, okay, the only way I'm going to look at that is the cost-benefit. I'm an engineer, numbers. What's the cost-benefit of Gardasil assuming some small percentage of harms? You know, in fairness, even the vaccine companies always say there will always be a small percentage of harms. There is no possibility of having a vaccine without that. Any effective drug will cause a problem with a small number of people. So you do the numbers and you look at the cervical cancer rates. You look at the ages of death and the quality adjusted life years lost from cervical cancer. And then you're very generous with the vaccine and you give it a 50% efficacy to stop the bug that kind of helps to push cervical cancer. It's a very, very weak chain of evidence. But let's say you give it a lot of credit. And you find that the numbers, the money per life saved or life year saved is kind of absurd. Because if you vaccinate everyone, it breaches all of the NIC guidelines in America, or sorry, in the UK. NIC have a guideline of 20,000 sterling per quality life year saved for a drug. And it sounds harsh, but you have to have a number. Otherwise, we spend $1 billion to save one person. You know, you need a number. And when I look at that vaccine and the cost versus the benefit and the actual rates of cervical, it makes no financial sense. So I always say I'm going to steer clear of all the harms and the vax stuff and just say, does it make basic financial sense according to NICE guidelines? And sadly, it doesn't. Yeah. So I'd say, well, there's my answer. And the coronavirus vaccine, looking at the coronavirus numbers, I mean, it's kind of like a vaccine for last year's flu-like illness. So you kind of missed the boat already, big time. And then when you look at the ages of the people who die, which generally exceeds the average life expectancy, and you look at the quality adjusted life years, and that 19 out of 20 in Ireland were actually already so near the door that they didn't even get ICU, and you're looking at what the vaccine is going to help with, and you look at the cost of vaccinating everyone, the cost benefit is out by a factor of 10 to 20. I mean, it's just the numbers. You don't have to get into harms. You don't have to get into the complicated science. Just the numbers. It makes no sense.
The numbers, the numbers itself. We'll get off vaccines. Number of people, we will, because I want to talk to you briefly about what's going on in Ireland, because you mentioned the scientists coming together. Great friend of mine has reminded me that the former head of the HSE in Ireland, Tony O'Brien, called the parents of the Gardasil injured emotional terrorists. I remember that. I've interviewed many of these parents and I interviewed some of their doctors and they remain convinced that they became very unwell after this vaccine. Final thing on vaccines from my point of view, and then I want to talk about what can be done going forward to prevent this crazy dystopian society that we seem to be kind of rushing headlong into. I interviewed a very well-respected German-based epidemiologist recently called Sukarat Bhakti. Very, very well-respected guy.
Ah, yes. Lovely man.
Real gentleman, yeah. And he was very good on the programme. And he expressed great concern about the vaccine only because it's new, the RNA-DNA vaccine. And because we won't know for years and years and years and years what it might mean for people. And he talked about it and the impact it could have on us and on our DNA, and he seemed to be very reticent to, you know, to endorse it. And I just thought that was interesting because we're not talking about vaccines of old. These vaccines will be very brand new technology. I don't know if you want to have a word on that very quickly, and we'll quickly move on then.
I'll mention a word again. I'm steering clear of it because even talking in a scientific sense,
I know you'll get in trouble, I know.
Yeah, yeah. But I will say something that no one can contest. So I spoke to a top immunologist, I mean tippy top, and he told me that, well, the problem with the RNA vaccines, yes, they go into your cells in your body and they take over your DNA machinery to replicate themselves, like a normal virus infection. And then you create the antigen and then your immune system reacts. And the advantage is they're cheaper and much faster cycle time to produce. So that's the advantage. But he said the problem is because they go into your actual cells and take over your, you know, DNA machinery, even though that's what a normal virus does, you know, it's maybe not that big a deal. People are not going to accept them for maybe 30 years. But he said you can get them in 6 months on the back of a corona crisis. So he said that's what a lot of the pressure is. They can use the corona crisis to get in a class of drug that really would have taken decades because of people's fear.
Decades.
So, yeah, probably. I mean, I don't know, probably. So that's one of the drivers. That said, he did say he didn't think they were a big deal. So they use an adenovirus, some of them. They use an actual virus to behave like a virus and bring in, you know, the protein that you want your immune system to react to. And he views it, and I'm inclined to agree with him, it's kind of just pretty much like being infected with another virus, probably. But the problem is, of course, the rush cycle and the newness. That probably isn't quite good enough.
Obviously. Hey, what about, before we talk again, because I do want to finish on that point about what's happening in Ireland with the scientists coming together. I'm not going to be negative, but I'm going to ask you in a second, how do you get past the media? Because the media seems to be a gatekeeper for this agenda. So before you answer that, the absolute final question on vaccines. My GP is in her 80s, late 80s, still alive and still practicing. And I speak regularly to a very well-known GP who's in his 70s, early 80s. What happened to the old way of doing things, that we just get these things and we get over them and our immune systems become more robust? I mean, you've done extraordinary things in your own work, you know, about nutrition. What happened to, you know, building a robust immune system by dealing with these things rather than taking the vaccines? Do you want to give me as quick an answer as you can on that, and then we'll talk about the future?
Well, as is often the case, I mean, obviously the old phones were not better than the new phones, but the old stuff was better. Now, I just say, if you really wanted to limit the impacts of SARS-CoV-2, this virus, it's actually not that difficult at all. Unfortunately, there's no money in it. So insulin resistance, leptin resistance, type 2 diabetes physiology is an absolute epidemic. And you can address that within days and weeks. You can actually address it within days and weeks. And this is published from Virta Health, from Redicare in Ireland, other trials with humans. If you switch to real food, which is a big ask because over 50% of the calories in the UK now come from ultra-processed foods, which drive type 2 diabetes. But if you switch to real food only, like meat, fish, eggs, and vegetables, within days, your system metabolically would be recovering. And your immune system will recover with it, right? Because leptin resistance is the problem, and leptin is part of the cytokines and it's part of the immune system and other reasons. So basically, if you took two twins, I always say this, if you took John and James, and they're both middle-aged, kind of pot-bellied accountants, and they're both obviously type 2 diabetic, but most are never diagnosed, but they're type 2 diabetic if you check properly. And if you took John and James, and John suddenly only ate meat, fish, eggs, and vegetables, got magnesium, potassium, some critical elements, got sun exposure, ultraviolet, you know, for nitric oxide, blah, blah, blah. You do a bunch of stuff that's in our book. John will look totally different than James in 3 or 4 weeks. And his blood tests, metabolically, his health, will be utterly different. And his immune system will be utterly more capable. And if you sprayed SARS-CoV-2 in a big blast into both James and John, John, who did the stuff, might get a mild flu-like illness. James might even end up in an ICU.
Right.
And I can't prove that, but all of the science says that. We know from the data from SARS-CoV-2 and COVID already gathered from months ago that that's broadly the case. It attacks the type 2 diabetic, COPD, immunocompromised, you know, aged because they're insulin resistant slash diabetic. As you get older, that's a modern reality. We know this. But no government said anything about what I just said. Nothing. Lockdown, lockdown, lockdown. And we know from the published science that lockdown gives bugger all benefit. And we know from the published science and anecdotal and doctors that lockdown destroys societies. We know all this. So what we're seeing is absurd.
I have a final question, and thanks for coming on today. In maybe in the early new year, I'd love to talk to you about your book and about this subject. I'd love to have you back if you wanted to come back. Don't commit to it now. You don't have to commit to it now. Ivor can be found on YouTube. Just look for Ivor Cummins. There isn't any other. Huge channel, very popular there with excellent interviews and presentations. He's also, of course, at thefatemperor.com, and it's at fatemperor on Twitter. Final question. Lovely that doctors, scientists, academics coming together. We've seen it with the great Barrington people. Kulldorff was on this show, but the media basically blacked them out. How are you going to, final question, 2 or 3 minutes before we have to wrap it up, how are you going to deal with that in Ireland? Because I don't see the Irish media as being any better than the media here in the UK.
Right. Well, I would say that RTE is a significant problem for sure. I mean, that's I've come to calling it Pravda Ireland. It's unbelievable. They have neuroscientists like Tomás Ryan on every other night, who's an amnesia specialist, right? Neuroscientist, who's telling us exactly how we need to lock down and hide under the bed to get zero COVID, which is inexplicable in its own right. What is a neuroscientist doing round the clock on the national broadcaster telling us what to do? But that's another question. So RTE are kind of lost. But they did on primetime last Friday have Professor John Lee, who utterly schooled Tomás Ryan and utterly upended him. So that's good. So we're seeing green shoots of even RTE beginning tentatively to show the truth and the reality. The Irish Times has transformed in the last few weeks. I think the doctors group is connected to one of their main or several of their main journalists, and we're seeing a flurry of truthful articles now saying what I'm saying broadly. And I think the Sun may change very shortly because there are ongoing discussions there. So I think the media themselves, they were paid a lot of money to drive this narrative, and I guess they believed they were driving the correct narrative. They were paid by the Irish Broadcasting Authority, and same in England, same all over the world. People were paid off to give the message that we're all going to die. But now they're beginning to realize that they're actually journalists, and they're beginning to realize they were duped. And luckily, there's enough decent men and women left in journalism to begin to say, hold on a minute, we're here to give both sides of the story and to discuss the differences and get to the truth. And I think there's an awakening. And the Spectator in England, the Telegraph, there's kind of this bizarre, what's that word again with split personality? God, I got a mental fart here. You know, the split personality cliche.
Right.
Schizophrenia.
There's
a schizophrenia in the media in the last month where the same newspaper is coming out with outrageous junk science from the narrative about there's no herd immunity, which is absurd. Blah, 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 second wave could be worse. And the very same newspapers coming out with articles from informed scientists who are saying, hold on a minute, we should do what Sweden are doing. So we're seeing this schizophrenia, and I think that's going to shift. It can only go one way. Unless they put the army on the streets and take over the media, it can only go one way, and that's towards the truth, the scientific truth, which I've stood my whole life for. It has to go that way. This thing is so absurd, it simply has to collapse under the weight of its own ludicrous anti-science. It just has to.
If there is a God, I pray you're right, Ivor. Because, you know, I do what I do. My partner isn't, in terms of her own employment status, she's not affected by it. But everybody we know is in dire financial straits. And we know the statistics in the country about the average bank account. We know the average man and woman, the average working man and woman, has only got a few hundred quid in the account. It's catastrophic. You perfectly described the problems. This is going, it's decades and decades of problems for people. I pray you're right. I see the same articles in the Telegraph. I see them in the Mail. Schizophrenic. Wonderful way to describe it, because even today, reading the Mail and the Telegraph, you do see these stories about, we need to lock down, we need to, and then you see these other excellently written articles saying, well, no, this is crazy, we've got to stop it. So I hope you're right. I've really enjoyed having you on. Thanks for giving us your time today. TheFatEmperor.com. Again, when I mentioned you were coming on, you were no stranger whatsoever to many of our listeners, and they do watch you on YouTube.com as well. Eat Rich, Live Long, terrifically well-reviewed book, co-written by Ivor and Jeffrey Gerber. And I'm going to order a copy of it when I get off air, Ivor, and I hope in the new year, I hope we're in a better situation than we are now, and that we will have time to talk about the themes in that book, because they're probably more important now than they were when you wrote the book in the first place. So thanks again for coming on, and Godspeed to you. Look after yourself, and I hope we can do it again.
Great stuff, Richie, and delighted. Late notice, don't care. Give me a call anytime.
Thanks, Ivor. Ivor Cummins, folks, on the Richie Allen Radio Show, closing out the programme this afternoon. TheFatEmperor.com. At Fat Emperor is the Twitter account. He mentioned earlier on, Ivor, he wouldn't get into, and I think he's absolutely right not to do that. He talked about the Great Reset. He talked about the Fourth Industrial Revolution, and he wouldn't be drawn on, you know, his own personal opinions of those agendas, but he described them absolutely brilliantly as to those people who have taken advantage of this. Great stuff. Good stuff. Thanks to David Curtin for coming on the programme earlier on as well. David, the Heritage Party, founded a Heritage Party recently, better known for UKIP. He's, of course, a London Assembly, member of the London Assembly, and he's running for mayor next year. Interesting stuff this evening. And a lot of comments came in when Ivor was on air. Thanks for them. You can see what people were tweeting me by going to twitter.com, where it says search Twitter. Just put in Richie Allen Show, all one word, no spaces even. And if you press enter, you'll see what people were tweeting to me. Right. I do have some guests booked in tomorrow. I don't have the diary to hand, so I can't tell you who they are. But I'll be back with you tomorrow at 5 o'clock UK time for a Thursday's Richie Allen Radio Show. In the meantime, look after yourselves and one another. Closing out with Louis. I hope we do have all the time in the world as well. Maybe we do. See you tomorrow. Bye.